Blog Talk Radio. Firefly Willows LIVE presents Evolve, featuring your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us on this episode of Evolve, Nurturing the New in Consciousness, the Arts, and Culture, with your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney. Evolve brings you people and ideas on the cutting edge of change, opening the shells of the past to move our culture into the now. The arts and evolving consciousness are how we are bringing that change to the culture at large. Evolve brings you the wise, the foolish, and the heart-based to help us meet the challenges of the times we are in. Your host in helping you evolve is Robin White Turtle Lisney, who received her master's in fine arts from Mills College in creative writing in 2012 and her PhD in energy medicine in 2013. She is an author of 3 books, the most recent being Heart Path, Learning to Love Yourself and Listening to Your Guides. She has published poetry in many literary journals and numerous anthologies, and her poem First Step was selected for reading by survivors at the Virginia Tech Memorial Bench dedication in April 2010. In addition to her writing, Robin is also an artist whose work has been shown widely throughout the Midwest and East Coast. Robin White Turtle Lisney is a psychic medium and energy medicine practitioner through East West Bookstore in Mountain View, California, through her office in Santa Cruz, California, and across the country by phone. Robin travels across the country as a speaker and leading workshops. To find out more about Robin, you can visit her website at www.thecenterforthesoul.com. So take a breath, relax, and let yourself evolve with your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney.
Welcome to Evolve. This is Robin White Turtle Lisney, and today I have a special guest, Carmen Mauch, who is here to talk about Burners Without Borders. Carmen is the founder and executive director of Burners Without Borders, which is a grassroots organization that creates participatory models for international disaster relief and supports innovative strategies that build resilience in communities around the globe. Carmen has nearly 20 years of experience in designing programs at the grassroots level that bring about community-driven change. While working in France as a volunteer with the human rights organization ADT Quartet Monde, she witnessed firsthand how everyday people can come together to overcome societal limitations and systematic impasses to build stronger communities. Since that time, Carmen has been employing participatory methodologies that harness the energies of the and gifts of the community in order to foster collaborative solutions that make a lasting impact. She holds a master's degree in transformative leadership from California Institute of Integral Studies, where she became an enthusiastic student of the art of facilitating the conditions in a community that can evoke positive change. Welcome, Carmen. I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you, Robin. I'm so happy to be here.
So today we're going to talk about Burners Without Borders. And I understand that Burners Without Borders got its start at Burning Man, at the Burning Man Festival. Can you talk about that and how it is that Burning Man and Burners Without Borders are intertwined or connected?
Yes. Well, for those who may not be familiar with the Burning Man event in the Black Rock Desert, we just finished it up a couple weeks ago. This event happens every year in the Black Rock Desert, just north of Reno. And it's been going on for about, I guess, you know, almost 30 years now. And I think the best thing about it and what's relevant for Burners Without Borders is that it operates on a gift economy for 1 week. And so the city, rather than a festival with main stages, it's a city where everyone participates in creating really the kind of communities they want to live in. And it's highly creative and a lot of participatory art and a perfect incubator for, you know, really new ideas and different experiments that people want to do. So it made sense when Katrina hit the Gulf Coast during Burning Man in 2005 that people would go and see what they could do with, to help with all their great skills and talents and everything they need to live in the desert. And so when people got down to Mississippi and started helping, we thought, you know, this is a lot of creativity at Burning Man, but how do we bridge that to people, you know, who need help and where we make a difference? And so Katrina was really the perfect place to, again, practice this and see what we could do for a community who had lost everything.
So Katrina hit and Burning Man was happening, and that was kind of the catalyst of Burners Without Borders. Is that right?
Yes, and because it's such a harsh environment in the Black Rock Desert, it's a prehistoric lake bed, so it's really dry and kind of caustic, and so you need a lot to survive out there. And people thought, well, the stuff that's helping us survive in, you know, the Black Rock Desert can help people survive in New Orleans and on the Gulf Coast. So they took their generators and everything down there to see what they could do, you know, to help out with the effort.
Oh, wow. So that's so they actually went from Burning Man down to Katrina sites and to help people in with their generators and all the things they had at Burning Man.
Yes.
Wow, that's fantastic. So talk a little bit about what they did when they were, once they got to Katrina, once they got down there, because that was quite a huge event for the whole world, really, not just for our country. But.
Well, it's a really interesting story because the some of the builders for the temple, Burning Man has a temple every year, those builders had a crane, and they drove down to Biloxi, Mississippi, and started, and they found another temple that was a Vietnamese Buddhist temple, and they had taken on water up to the attic, and were just, you know, didn't really have the means to get everything out of their, you know, everything that had come in from the ocean out of their parking lot. So we started taking out, well, at the time, it was only just a few people, but they started using that crane to remove all of the debris and then start a distribution center with all of the, you know, millions of tons of things that were coming in, but, you know, there was just no room to put it. So we started helping out there. And then when it came time to stop the distribution portion, we rehabbed that temple and to help that community be able to stave off the corruption that was coming, because the city was coming in and rezoning entire neighborhoods and condemning houses that didn't need to be condemned because they wanted to bring those casinos that were no longer allowed on the water inland. And so they came around and started trying to rezone, and because we were able to have this community center here that was really built beautifully, rebuilt in 3 months, we were able to give them a place to meet so that when they could join together and actually, you know, keep their land and their homes.
Mm, wow. Wow. So you really had an instrumental, Burners Without Borders really got its start in a very instrumental way by actually producing a community center inside this Buddhist center. Is that correct? This Buddhist temple. So then that's so exciting because really that gave the community a foundation to begin to not have the powers that be the only voice, but to actually have it rise out of the people's voice and what the people needed.
Yes, and we realized that, you know, we're not FEMA. We can't come in and distribute millions of bottles of water. We can't come in and have the impact that a federal agency can, but we can, as just a small group of like 20 people, most of the time down there, can make a big impact if you look for the leverage points in the system. So rather than just, you know, eventually we were given front loader and excavator that allowed us to change the landscape of towns very quickly, and also save each person $10,000 for having to pay to have their house removed so they could access federal resources.
Mm.
So it's really, you know, what I learned is anybody can do anything, and a small group of people can really, you know, take on the Gulf Coast and actually make a big difference. And that was a lot of what got us you know, now going for 8 years, because it was such a rich, fertile, organic environment to figure out, like, what do we want to do with this creativity? How do we want to take this problem solving into our own communities?
Mm-hmm. So after you came back from the Gulf Coast, how did Burners Without Borders begin to include supporting people in starting their own initiatives and with its mission? I mean, how did it begin to form? Because you got it going, and you were kind of the one who catalyzed things in a certain way, and yet people are acting independently. How did that work when you came back from the Gulf Coast?
Well, Burners Without Borders today has really grown with the communities and what its interests are. And what I always thought was Burners Without Borders is a tool that we pick up that has, you know, out of the box creativity, creatively thinking about our communities and how our gifts and talents can contribute to them becoming, you know, again, the kind of cities and communities we want to live in. And, you know, we didn't know how to bridge this. A lot of people thought that Burners Without Borders would be something that happened in the past, and then that was great. We did $1.5 million worth of debris removal in Katrina. That's great. And then, you know, we'll just leave it there. But I really thought, I think this community is ready to, you know, do something with this creativity. And so I started having beach cleanups in San Francisco when we came back. And from cleaning up the beaches, we found out from Surfrider that the National Park Service wanted to ban fires at Ocean Beach. And so we came up with a creative solution that actually helped them take care of some of their problems with debris on the beach and et cetera, and solve problems for them that allowed to this day bonfires are allowed at Ocean Beach. And so from there, we thought, you know, it seems like this kind of, you know, creative thinking is really needed in the world, and the National Park Service loved it. So how can we encourage people to help their communities become stronger by working with other people and maybe organizations to make it happen, rather than this paradigm of pushing against how do we join arms and solve our problems together? And that's really been the kind of motivation for people to get involved with Burners Without Borders in their local communities, because they want to bring this kind of creativity in and really see what can happen.
Well, that's exciting. So you started with beach cleanups, and did I understand you right? You have like 25 projects going all the time, or like,
yeah.
So talk about that a little, because that's so exciting.
Yes,
so,
when Burners Without Borders first started, you know, people thought, oh, you'll continue to do disaster relief, and I said, no, that's just one thing we're going to do, because it's really good. We have this, you know, a incredibly creative community that includes people who are, you know, young and discovering the world, to Sergey Brin, who started Google, and so the media can think that Burning Man is this community that just goes out, you know, to party in the desert for a week, but there is so much creativity that gets brought back after that week, and that's what we're interested in being a part of. And the 25 projects that we have going at any one time, it's because the community has decided to do something. And we rarely, in the disaster world, I may start projects, but it's really the community that goes to the website, sees all the things that other people have done at burnsoutborders.org, and then starts thinking about, you know, maybe I won't do that exact project, but that does, you know, remind me of something I could do. And then I can see how that project went from just an idea to an extraordinary outcome that maybe no one saw, but all the conditions and the pieces were put in place for it to be successful. And that's what we want to do, is we want to help people create more successful projects that actually grow community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to throw money at things, but when we throw community at problems, it only makes it, you know, the community grow and stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we encourage people to do.
So how do you support people then from taking a project from the idea stage to manifesting that idea? Because that's a huge, being a creative person myself, having been community organizer, I know how challenging it is. Like, people want to kind of depend on or lean on the kind of the leader. And then you, as the leader, you end up kind of putting out all your creative juices, and people are kind of just following along, but they're not really engaged. So it sounds like you have ways of bringing the idea into fruition through the people that you want to engage. So how do you get them from idea to manifesting?
Well, one thing we have going for us is that people really feel like they're a part of something larger in the Burning Man community. You can, you know, if you've been to Burning Man or, you know, not, and you go to a town and someone asks, you know, to connect or sleep on someone's couch, that community is right there for you. And it's just incredible to see. And so when something happens like a disaster, the community is extremely responsive right away. And because our community has grown, it's not just Burning Man folks now. It's people who are interested in creativity. It's interested in people who want to organize their community. And so it's just really incredible to see how generous people are with what they want to give, and how easy it is then just to support it. Because when we start with what we care about, and we start in our heart, it's a lot easier to know what the next step is. And I think that's something we learned in Katrina, because there's a lot of people who were sitting around for 4 months waiting for someone to come and take down their house that was need to be taken off the lot. And they would have sat there for another, I think, probably 6 months had we not come in and helped them. And I thought, you know, people need to know, we need to be stronger in our community to help ourselves when we can. And Katrina is an extreme case, but there's a lot of times where we do wait for, you know, the laws to come around without thinking we need to participate in it. And we're really here to say, you know, when you participate, your community gets better. And when you come from your heart with really what you, the challenges you see in your community, things can heal in ways that we didn't expect. And it's because we start becoming a tractor for other people who are like, hey, you know, I want to help you. I want to support you as well.
So it's through mutual support to some extent that you get the idea off the ground and get it into manifestation. So what I'm, is that what I'm hearing? That's pretty exciting. So how have the volunteers been transformed by engaging the work that you're doing with Burners Without Borders?
Well, that's my favorite part, and I have just been deeply touched by how generously people give of themselves and welcome others into also making it a success. And so it's I think the place I've seen the most transformation on a daily basis is when we had a 6-year project in Pisco, Peru, following an 8.0 earthquake that leveled the city that lasted for about 2 minutes. And we started bringing international volunteers in, sometimes 100 at a time, 60 at a time on a daily basis, basically in a volunteer cooperative where people could, you know, help raise money. They could be in a leadership position, even if they've never been in a leadership position before. And what we saw was is that every day when I was there for about 2 years of the 6 years, every night people would be asking me, you know, how do we do this all the time? I've never made an impact like this in the world. I didn't know that it was possible. I want to keep doing this all the time. And so now we have people who've stopped their finance jobs so that they could go and learn more about service work and, you know, whatever it is they want to do. We've actually had 5 nonprofit organizations, 3 international, who have come just from people volunteering. So I think it's hard. It can be hard to help people in society. And I think there needs to be places where we can practice it together and people can, you know, see what it's like to learn and not know while you're learning. But then, oh, there's this outcome at the end that was unexpected, even though, you know, we didn't know how we were going to get there in the beginning. And I think it's when people have those experiences, it's extremely transformative, and it gives them, you know, people said they feel like they have more vision after, you know, volunteering us for just 2 weeks. Like, they understand so much better what's possible. And they're thinking in a yes way rather than, no, that would never work. And someone will look at you strangely on one of our projects if you were to say that, because it's like, oh, no, anything's possible. So when we live in that reality, then, you know, what do we want to do together? And anything is really possible.
How exciting. I mean, I'm getting excited just listening to you about it. So talk about some of the other projects that you've had, because you've had projects, like you said, down in Cusco and other places all over the world from Burners Without Borders.
Well, yeah, we have quite a few projects. We have over 30 projects right now. And again, they're all started by people like you and me who just want to see what they can do. And so we had one of my favorite stories is the when people try to take on things in their society that other people might not think are possible. And one of my favorite examples is how citizens have been finding creative ways to support their local SPCA by finding homes for animals that would otherwise, you know, they would have to be killed to make room for more. And so in Northern Canada, we gave these guys $400 to try to solve this problem with stray animals that were having to be put down due to the low population of people in this northern region. So a small group of three people didn't really like that all these animals were being killed in their community, and they noticed that cargo planes that were coming in full of cargo were leaving empty. So they asked for $400 to buy dog kennels so that the dogs could be put on those empty planes and returned to a more populated area where they could be adopted. So this is a great example of how the community identified a challenge and is creatively solving it with their available resources. And so, you know, that's just a small example, but it's a way of looking at the world and your resources that then allows for more possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we create new relationships among ideas that weren't there before, it's everything opens up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and mm-hmm. and then we have, you know, kind of higher profile projects in Haiti where we're creating a screen printing business with local Haitians who are, you know, generally marginalized because of their to be women or lesbian, gay identified or transgender, and it's very hard to make a living. So for this is the first program like this in Haiti where we're actually bringing professional skills and entrepreneurial skills so that it's not just about design, it's about taking your idea to market. And since the earthquake, there's really no way to screen print or do anything in this town in Jacmel. And so it's going to be a success, and it is a success. It's been going on for about 10 months, and we're going to be able to show UN and USAID really, you know, what is possible. And we can't do this all ourselves, so we just want to create small possible, you know, small places where people can see, oh, that's working,
mm-hmm.
and then they can pick it up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm. and where are they selling? Are they selling these shirts or the screen printing to people in the local community, or are they selling it like outside? Do they have international support for the
yep.
sales of their things?
Sure do. People are really excited by this project when they see it in action in Haiti, or they hear about it, or see a video of people going from design to screen printing, because it's just believing in people, and it's knowing that people can change. And when we shine a light on that, you know, we have people who are in Canada who want to buy these t-shirts, and then we have people in town who don't have postcards, and it's a beautiful, really, it's a beautiful village right on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And so when there's a cholera outbreak, they don't have ways to make copies, and being able to screen print and make different you know, posters when there's outbreaks will make all the difference. So
mm-hmm.
just these small ways that we can interject just a little bit of knowledge and skills into an area, you just watch people go with
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And same with this project we have in Kenya, in the biggest slum in Mombasa. We've created a complementary currency program that's helping people save their national currency for things they can't get from each other so that they're in much better position to be able to, you know, save and take care of their family. And that project was so seen as, you know, kind of threatening to the Kenyan government that they almost put seven people in jail for 7 years because they called it counterfeit. And so through this process, we've been able to educate the Kenyan government that, no, this is actually something that's happening in the world. It's here to stay. And now we can do the work, now that they've dropped the charges, we can do the work of actually spreading it to the rest of Africa now.
Mm.
So what started out as a small project in someone's mind is now going to potentially be on, you know, people's phones all across Africa, and in a better system than is in place now.
So the currency that you're this complementary currency, how does that exactly work? It wasn't really replacing the bona fide currency that the Kenyan government had, but it was used in exchange for, like, I do this for you and I give you five complementary dollars, and you do something for me, and or is that kind of how it worked? Or,
well, what we did, I was just there in January, and we brought all the business folks together from the slum. And so there's people who sell water, there's people who change tires, anything you need or imagine, you know, people selling vegetables is present there. And what before they had been using was the national currency, and that moved around the community, but it was something that kept them from being able to buy things on the outside. And
mm-hmm.
so this complementary currency that was created, first of all, there's no way it could have been counterfeit because it was so beautiful, and it is so beautiful. It's all of the businesses that are present here are artfully rendered. So a woman is beautifully, you know, maybe stirring this pot, and a man is doing something. It's just gorgeous, and the community loved it. And what they do is they start, the project has started with these business owners. they're more or less trading with this currency, and then they will have the national currency to be able to go out and get their other things or bring things back into the community. But it's running parallel with the national currency, and this is really popular all over the world right now, and it's I'm not going to remember the name of the man who's the expert in this, but one of the things he said in defense of our volunteer in Kenya is that this is one of the only things and kind of tools that can help people come out of poverty. And, you know, we have the Hague and the UN behind us on this mm-hmm. as well. So it's really interesting to see just kind of turning it, rather than dumping a lot of money in, just changing slightly, shifting just a little bit about how people think about money, and then, you know, allow them to dream more, because now they have money, they're in society, they have access to resources. So it's really exciting. We're excited to see where it can go.
Mm-hmm. So the this complementary currency is not competing with the currency, but it's used among the business owners to kind of exchange services. Is that kind of how it works?
Yes, and it will be spreading to the rest of the population once it gets going with the businesses. And how we started this was in another slum outside of Nairobi. There was, you know, just trash everywhere, and seemed like there was really no way to get rid of it. And so Burners Without Borders injected $500 into this community to be able to print $500 worth of money in a different currency. And kids would pick up the trash. They would get money for picking up the trash, and then they could go buy eggs, and they could go, you know, do different things only within their community. And because, and there was rules around, you know, like the idea is to get rid of the money, you know, to get the money really going quickly in the community. And that's still going today, but that there's a lot of different ways to do it. So it mm-hmm. just depends on the environment. Uh-huh. And, you know, they're really kind of evolved in this slum in Mombasa. These business owners really have their act together. They had great ideas about everything when we did this demonstration with them, and they had great questions and knew exactly how to solve certain things. And
isn't that exciting?
And they're backing their own money. It's
wow.
the community that's backing their money. We didn't give them $500. We gave them money to print it, but they're the ones responsible. Are you going to pay me back? You know,
yeah.
And if you lose money, it's 3 to 4 people who lose that money, so one person doesn't take the hit. So there's tons of ways, you know, that we can start bringing creative ideas into these places that would normally just be thought of as, well, that's going to be a slum forever and you can't make it out.
Right.
Starting to show those possibilities that, oh, no, actually, we can. You know,
uh-huh.
Very quickly, actually.
Uh-huh. How exciting. Well, I'm here today with Carmen Mauch, who's the Executive Director of Burners Without Borders, and we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back. Robin White Turtle Listening, and this show is Evolve,
interested in the arts and communities and how we can create the new world that's emerging today. My guest today is Carmen Mock, who's the executive director and founder of Burners Without Borders, which is a grassroots organization that creates participatory models for international disaster relief and supports innovative strategies that build resilient communities around the globe. And we've been talking about different projects she has in Africa and that are going all over the world, really, in Haiti. And you've just finished a project in South America this year. It's so exciting. I don't know if I told you, but I was a community organizer here in the Santa Cruz Mountains for about 2 years, and we had an incident. This is one example that didn't come from Burners Without Borders, but it's how the community rose up. We had an incident there back, I don't know when it was, a few years ago, where an African-American person was slandered on the street in public and hit, attacked by a white woman who was drunk and not in a happy mood. And what we did is organized around this woman who was beaten up basically for no reason except that she was African-American in the middle of Boulder Creek. And we created Martin Luther King a day of peace, and we had speakers come, and we did a protest and said we're taking back Boulder Creek and that this is not the way Boulder Creek is, and we're not going to allow this kind of behavior here. And we were able to get the woman to come and talk, and who was attacked. And you know, it was a really amazing uprising out of a need, which was to, you know, help the community come into greater consciousness and not let it just go down to the lowest common denominator. So it's very exciting to be a part of projects like that. And yours are mostly volunteer, so you have people that are volunteering in these projects all over the world, which is so exciting. So talk to me about, you mentioned that the U.S. Department of Defense is interested in learning from how Burners Without Borders has implemented different kinds of disaster recovery around the globe. What advice do you have for how citizens' efforts, local efforts, can influence policy in our government? Because that's a big conundrum we're all facing today.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for sharing that beautiful story. I love knowing about everyday citizens just getting together about what they care about and just doing something very beautiful in this case about it. So it's just so heartening to know that, it's really, everything starts at the grassroots level, and your story is a perfect example. When I was in college, I was going to go and become a lawyer and stand up for our rights and do international policy and all this stuff. And what I learned, thank goodness, I took a moment to volunteer in France. What I noticed is that really sustainable change starts at the grassroots level in our local communities, and then everything can filter up and scale up from there into our policies. But I think people don't understand often how easy it is to get involved, especially in your local community's governance. And that's really where we all want to start. Mm-hmm. It is difficult to go right to the top of federal agencies, walk and talk to Obama and tell him what you think. But we do have these mechanisms that we often forget in our own communities. And so, and we're so lucky to live in the Bay Area, in Berkeley and Santa Cruz, where so many wonderful things that ended up showing the world started here. Mm-hmm. From, the first city in, I think, the United States to allow medical marijuana to be used. And, I'm sure nobody thought that they're trying to stake out and be the first people to do anything. It's just solving a community problem. Mm-hmm. And so then you end up, when something is working in your community and you get involved and you show up at your city council meetings and talk to your neighbors. Mm-hmm. That's something I think we've lost. Mm-hmm. And it's almost, a lost art, really, because mm-hmm. that's what keeps the fabric of a community together, when we know mm-hmm. each other's names and care about each other. Mm-hmm. And what I've found is when we start with these kind of unextraordinary, can seem just, ideas or, how are we going to move forward on this? Or just, really makes you mad they're polluting in this river, but I can't do anything, mm-hmm. Well, we actually can. And one of my favorite stories is some housewives called me from Nevada and said, they're wanting to take all of San Francisco's trash on a train and dump it out here on one of our beautiful playas. They haven't done an impact report. They haven't done anything. And we're afraid this trash is going to blow everywhere and it's going to get into our water system. And they call themselves Housewives for Nevada. And I didn't really know how to help them. And so I just kept thinking about it. And I talked to some more people and I gathered some information. And then I told them 10 things that I thought they could do to raise this out of their small town in Nevada to a national level. And they did. And the Wall Street Journal ended up picking up the piece. And it was an op-ed. And they were, you know, on the side of these housewives. Mm-hmm. Everything changed after that moment when it went to the national level. Mm-hmm. And again, we were just like people on the phone, didn't know what we were doing. I didn't have any connections. And that has now, it's still in progress. That trash is not coming out there yet because those housewives did organize their community and they did create accountability for Recology coming in and, you know, doing the impact reports that you have to do and everything to assure people living there who really are stewards of that area that their beautiful landscape is going to remain the same. And so, you know, I didn't know, I have to say, I didn't know what we could do, but I just kept saying, there's a way. And that's what's incredible to me. Mm-hmm. And now that's making an impact at the state level because of those, they're organizing themselves in that way.
Right. So now tell me about the Department of Defense and their interests, because I'm really curious about that. Can you tell a little the story about how you got connected with them? I don't know if that's relevant, but
yeah.
I'm very interested in how you got to the Department of Defense. How do they?
Yeah, because just like with this Nevada, we didn't know we would make it to the state and have the senator's ear. When we started doing disaster relief, you know, we really didn't know what we were doing. We were just trying to move stuff out of the way so people could get back on their feet. It turned out to be the right thing to do. And when that, from what we've learned with our work in Peru, we went on to Haiti to, there's a very creative person named Sam Block who created Haiti Humanitaire after he was the head of our program in PSCO, and he has it's just amazing. What it is there's a bunch of different, I guess, buildings on the property. They're all made out of different alternative materials, from container housing to straw bale to, I think, Earthship folks came in and built an Earthship there.
And where is this?
And this is in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Oh, in Port-au-Prince.
And it's so expensive to stay in Haiti because it's all just nonprofit folks coming in, so it could be $100 a night. And he had the idea, what if we provide a space for these workers to come in where they can collaborate? You can stay in a tent for $20, you can stay somewhere for $80, and that money goes back to the Haitian community, and the Haitians get to use this entire space for free, from the conference room to welding to the workshop. Everything is for the Haitian community to become stronger with, and it's being funded by mostly Western people who come in and need a place to stay. And when I was there visiting, a NATO delegation came through, people from Italy and the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, and what they said is they wouldn't be able to believe this was possible if they hadn't seen it with their own eyes. And that's when I saw, you know, we've got the attention of the Department of Defense here. We've got the Pentagon looking at this and trying to figure out, you know, well, gosh, how are you guys doing this? How are you making such an impact? And that's what we do. Again, we're not going to go to Haiti and change that poverty problem that they've had for hundreds of years. But what we can do is create enough successes in this kind of, you know, small program that gets the attention of people in the Pentagon, and then they can take it forward and actually do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we make sure we get their contact and we give them updates, and now we're on a peer level with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're checking in, asking questions, inviting me to invite only DOD events where, you know, they're looking for different ways to do, you know, refugee camps and disaster scenarios in a more humane way. But they often get just caught up in the system, and the heart that they came in to do the job with sometimes gets subsumed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just here to show them what we can do and how we can help them.
So did you do a slideshow for the folks at the Department of Defense, or did you just had them come in and they saw at Haiti what was going on, or did you talk to them, or you had a speaking gig, didn't you, with the Department of Defense people?
Yes. I was asked to come to a Star Tides event in D.C. last year to talk about just the way that we do things, and it's more of the how of, you know, one of the things I brought to this event with my talk was a shelter that was inappropriate for the environment. And so that when generals and admirals and all these people who come in, who are often responsible for buying the shelters for an entire region after disaster, whether it's India, you know, wherever, they often don't know what an appropriate shelter is, but they're not going to forget once they've walked into an inappropriate one and they're really hot and they start sweating. And I said, you know, this is a great shelter. It's inappropriate for this environment. Mm-hmm. And that's all that needs to be said, really, mm-hmm. you know, and they have the experience and they get it. I was like, we don't, you know, I wouldn't want to spend one more second in here. And so it's really, you know, it can be playful and fun also. And then after I spoke, at the end of the day, I had a man from Africa come up to me and said, I want to give you everything I have. And I said, oh, really? What do you have? And he said, we build solar around the world in big ways. And so since then, I was able to connect him to my friends in Tanzania who are trying to protect the last corridor for all of the ungulates and the animals who are going into to the Serengeti on their way out of Tanzania. And he's provided all the solar for the anti-poaching. And just, you know, it's just incredible what can happen when you're just sharing your ideas.
Yeah, how exciting. So this was a conference that you were in. What is it called again, the Star?
Star Tides.
Star Tides. It's
the experimental part of the Department of Defense, where they're interested in really, like, how do we make refugee camps better? How do we bring more human element to these you know, huge disasters that are happening more and more around the world. And they're listening. That's what's really exciting. It's hard to see because it's all about connecting to people's hearts, you know. If I was standing across a desk from one of these guys, I don't think so. But when we're standing there trying to figure out a problem together and our hearts are connected to it because these folks want to make it work, you know. They don't want things to fail. Something else can happen, and that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, how exciting, how exciting. It must have been really thrilling to be able to connect with people that really have major influence and have the budget to do something.
Yes.
So that's also very exciting to be able to connect in that way with them.
Yeah, we just want to make everyone look good, you know.
Yeah.
And so a lot of our solutions, when I'm talking to some of these guys who've been in the Department of Defense for, you know, their whole lives, you know, that part of their heart is like, well, I want to be doing what you're doing. You know, like, can I come there? And, you know, we had some of these UN folks in Haiti and in Port-au-Prince working at our orphanages that we're working with because it was like a break from the job they were doing there for the UN, and they just loved it. They loved volunteering. And I'm like, I'm so glad I saw that, you know. You just don't, that's not what you see in the news and that's coming out of these disasters. It's really, you know, good people on the ground who want to do the right thing. We want to help them do the right thing.
How exciting. How exciting. Well, we're going to take another break, and we'll be right back with Carmen Mock, who's the executive director of Burners Without Borders. And we're talking about how you can have creative solutions in your own community. You don't necessarily have to go to another country to create community solutions. We'll be back in just a minute. Robin Lisney, Robin White Turtle Lisney, and I'm your host for Evolve. This is the radio show that talks about how we can move forward in our culture through the arts and through community organizing and all kinds of different things and creative solutions to our current culture.
I'm having a workshop this weekend on Sunday. It's going to be in Santa Cruz, and it's a soul collage with Janet Trenchard. We're creating a soul collage cards that also integrate HeartPath. HeartPath is a process I teach that helps people move into a greater evolutionary communion within themselves. It helps you stop hating yourself and start loving yourself. And we can combine it with the soul cards. And this time we're going to talk about the medicine wheel, teachings, and how to do soul card spreads. So we're going to be both making cards, and then we're going to be actually doing readings with each other. And it's this Sunday, and it's very reasonably priced. It's only $45, and there are two of us facilitating. We've got a few more spaces, so we'd love to have you join us. You can look at my website, thecenterforthesoul.com, in order to get more information and how to contact me. And we do need pre-registration. So I'm looking forward to seeing you at Soul Collage and Heart Path Workshop. I'm here today with Carmen Mauch, who's the Executive Director of Burners Without Borders. Burners Without Borders has taken different ideas, creative community ideas around the world, and has created all kinds of grassroots organizing that helps in different models for change within the community. And we were just talking about how even the U.S. Department of Defense invited you to come to speak to them at this great conference so that they could hear some of the problems that occur when inappropriate housing is brought into a situation like we were just talking on the break, like you wouldn't want to bring an igloo into India, but it can get that bad sometimes. And so can you give some examples of like what you were showing is appropriate housing in particular communities, especially, say, in Haiti, where it's very hot? You wouldn't want to bring something that has no windows or doors. So that would be something I'd like you to talk about
a little bit. I think over the years we've really learned that when you look around at what's around you, you get a lot of your answers answered pretty quickly to any problems you have. And, for instance, we noticed in Pisco, the reason why that town had been devastated after that 8.0 earthquake is because people didn't know how to build their homes. And a lot of those folks had been squatting, and they had basically, they called it adobe, but it wasn't, because adobe is strong. It's been used for thousands of years. But they had used dirt, and so no one was allowed to build with anything except brick and mortar after that earthquake. Well, people didn't have the money to buy a house. So we started trying to, to build their house again. So we started to figure out, well, what can we do here? We started looking around, and we found that there was a bag company, a food grade bag company, and they had tons of dirt laying around because of the earthquake and all the construction and everything that was happening they were dumping. So it seemed like, it's a desert environment, it doesn't rain, it's really loud there, kind of an urban environment that's really loud, a lot of honking. And so it seemed like earth bags were the way to go, where you take a bag, fill it with dirt. It's a brick and mortar concept, but it's actually much better. And it's, happening in California on a grand scale. People are building 4,000 and larger square foot homes with this. But for Peru, it was something they hadn't seen before. And so they had, somewhat inappropriate housing that they were building by cobbling together plastics that would end up burning, and there would be fires as these people were cobbling together their houses. And so we were able to bring a new building technology to this area that was appropriate, that people could actually afford. Mm-hmm. And it's still going today. And after all the schools and community centers we built with that, and now it's actually moved to the jungle. So that they're probably getting their bags from somewhere else, but they've seen now the technology and they're adapting to it in the jungle, and it's really perfect. And so we've done some things that weren't appropriate, where we brought in compost toilets to an area that didn't have electricity or really water, and we put them out there and explained how to use them. We came back and they didn't know how to use them, and they were overflowing. And we noticed, like, oh, people who don't have aren't accustomed to compost toilets, much like many of us in the West, it's not the first thing you think about, people not using them. And so, we've had to learn over the years what's appropriate, and we're just happy to pass those lessons on to anyone who asks, including the Department of Defense.
So now, what's your website, Carmen? Because you have a website for Burners Without Borders, and people can check out
you know, like right now, they could go check it out and see what kind of projects you're doing, and because you've got like over 25 projects in different countries. So what's your website?
It's burnerswithoutborders.org. You can just Google it, and mm-hmm. And it shows up, and you can check out our projects and that are there to help inspire folks, you know, mm-hmm. about what's possible. And we really want that website to also help anchor people's ideas, where they have like really good ideas, they want to tackle a problem, and it doesn't have to be all finished and done and perfect mm-hmm. to be up on the website, because we want to be using that as an activation space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you have a talent skill you can give? Maybe it's just on the phone. You know, we really want to be encouraging people to build stronger communities, you know, and do what we can for that. And it can often involve just very small things, you mm-hmm. know, just offering advice. You don't have to show up anywhere. Like you said, you don't have to go to another country.
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about the Department of Defense. I wonder what advice you have for people for how citizens can, local efforts can influence government policy. I mean, how do you get people motivated on a local level to really make a difference with, you know, the Department of Defense or anyone else in the government?
Yeah, we might think as they're in charge of our lives, but actually they're looking to us,
right.
to help them. Again, I think we have a lot of mechanisms in our local governance that allows us to have a voice. I visit quite a few countries around the world every year. Those people don't have that voice. They have the option to protest, often at risk of their own lives, once a decision has been made by the government. We see this in a lot of countries in Africa, Indonesia, for, you know, to some extent. But we have all these mechanisms. I think we can take them for granted, and then it's easy to complain later that it's not happening the way we want.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't realize that it would take our participation to make this happen, and that it's a community that makes a difference. And, you know, it's not our governance. We need to turn that around so we can be telling our governments what we expect from them. And
mm-hmm.
And, you know, some easy ways to do it is, you know, get involved. You know, like when I used to live in San Francisco, there was a disaster preparedness people that you could be connected to. It's connected to the city. And that was just a no-brainer to me, because if San Francisco has an earthquake, I want to be connected into the people who have the information and the resources.
Mm-hmm.
So already, if I'm in that system, I'm going to know more than most people on my street. I'm going to have more information at a time when that's what's really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I encourage people to, whenever you can, to pick up a role in your community that, you know, you may not think is, you know, useful for you now, but it can actually put you in a position to be able to protect yourself, your family,
mm-hmm.
and your community, rather than waiting to see what's going to happen or not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a big proponent of putting yourself in places that can make a difference. If
mm-hmm.
your community's invites you to city council meeting to talk about that, go talk to that, you know, make sure that your views are being covered.
Mm-hmm.
But also, as I said before, we're really in the business of making people look good. We're not in competition with the Department of Defense. We're not trying to show up anybody. We're trying to help the National Park Service solve its problems so we can enjoy fires at the beach. How do we do that?
Right.
And so I think the pushing against is now, we're coming to an end of that paradigm on the planet, I hope.
Right.
And really, again, like I said at the beginning, linking up arms with each other
mm-hmm.
and figuring these problems out, because they're not getting easier, folks. You know,
mm-hmm.
we got to take everybody.
Right.
And it's more fun when everybody's involved. So mm-hmm. I think there's, you know, a lot of different ways, but it's really just taking your ideas and having, just connecting with people, you
mm-hmm.
know, and being mm-hmm. on a peer level with them rather than seeing them as above you. I think that makes,
right.
I get a lot done, because I come in with people thinking we're equal.
Mm-hmm.
Changes everything.
Yeah,
know?
Right. Yeah. And I think that taking the leadership roll out and putting it in a community circle makes such a difference when you're working in a community setting.
Absolutely.
Because as you withdraw from kind of that leadership, you might be the catalyst that helps get everybody to the meeting. But then how do we create the agenda together? What is it that we're really wanting to talk about? And how do we free flow the information here so everybody's getting a voice?
Absolutely.
And that's a really, that's an artful way of community organizing, and a very good one, so that everyone feels like they're participating. So you were recently invited to speak to students at the Stanford Design School. Tell us about that. That sounded really exciting. And you were building better refugee camps. So talk a little bit about how Burning Man and how did they take this on, Burners Without Borders.
Well, it's really interesting. I met the head of the Stanford Design School at Burning Man, and he said, well, the UN has asked us to look at how to build a better refugee camp. And I just immediately asked him, what does Stanford know about building refugee camps? You guys are designers. And, mm-hmm. and he's like, well, we'd like to have you come in and talk about what you know about the community part of it. Not necessarily the architecture of mm-hmm. a camp, mm-hmm. even though they're, you know, kind of architecture students in a way, design students. And so I went after Burning Man, and I, you know, these kids are 23. No one's ever stepped into a refugee camp. I didn't really know what to offer or if I had anything to offer, because I really think you do need to be in an area before you give advice. But I started thinking about Burning Man and what kind of order has come out of the chaos there. And then before, I would think it was maybe 98, people just camped in the desert. And it was in 99 when the addresses started to appear so that I can be found now. I'm at 330 in Esplanade, and that's an address, that's a location in this vast 500 square mile desert that I can be located. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about refugee camps and how we have, you know, sometimes hundreds of thousands, you know, for sure tens of thousands of people living in an area. And how do you find another person? How do you create if everyone's just jumbled together? Mm-hmm. And so I looked at that idea, and then this idea of how, you know, what are the conditions for vibrant communities that we all love? Well, I like places where I can actually interact with the public, that people I don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And when we, there's an architect who has this idea, I don't remember his name, but he has this idea for designing for the most participation among citizens per square foot.
Oh, how exciting.
And so it's like, ah, and when we started to combine those two ideas in the classroom, you could just see that the problem has not been solved, but they've been given the scope of what's possible. So we're not going to design, you know, what's the best shelter. We're going to think about what does it mean for you to belong in your community and what do you need? And out of that, if people feel like they belong in their community, so much more is going to be possible, even mm-hmm. if it is a refugee camp.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Wow. How exciting. So you took ideas that you created out of Burning Man and all living out there in the desert together and having like actual addresses develop out of the Burning Man camp into actual refugee camps so that you can make and create, begin to create ways that these refugee camps can become communities. Yes. Because some of them are going on for 10, 15, 20 years. And there are kids that are born right there in the refugee camp and never get out of it. So why not create a better community there? And hopefully they'll be able to move on and move back into a peaceful world. But that doesn't always happen, as we know. So that's very exciting.
And the community is represented in these refugee communities. They are doctors, lawyers. You know, everyone has to flee. It's not because you
right.
have a white-collar job that you can stay. So,
right.
you know, that's how we need to think of people, the gifts and talents they're bringing.
Right,
so that's
right.
That's what can create community very quickly.
Right, right. So creativity seems to be a real undercurrent that's part of Burners Without Borders here. How can a community bring more creativity into how they solve problems with each other?
Well, it's a really simple answer. It's really important for people to have fun. And when you know and give yourself permission to have fun, everything changes. And I feel like when we laugh together, we break bread together, and we take the time to hear each other's stories, that's how the foundation of community is created. And then it's much more likely for out-of-the-box thinking to occur when this foundation is there because you've built trust among people. They'll dare to say an idea that they might not think can work, but they don't know you that well, but, you know, they really, you know, want to see it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the more trust and the more really kind of heart-connected we are with each other, the more it is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens when people start to gather, not around the project, but around the people in their community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How exciting. So how can our listeners get more involved with Burners Without Borders or start their own projects right where they are in their own communities?
Yeah, we definitely encourage you to go to the website and just, you know, kind of poke around and see how you're inspired. We're not the only organization on the block doing this, but we're one, and we're here to help you really take whatever idea you have or whatever you care about and help manifest solutions or, you know, community organizing in your own community. And you're welcome to contact me at any time. I'm kind of a one-woman show on this, even though we have lots of volunteers. It's Carmen, Carmen, at burnerswithoutborders.org.
And the website is burnerswithoutborders.org, right? Uh-huh. So what new projects are on the horizon for Burners Without Borders?
Well, right now, we have folks in Colorado assessing the damage there. We've already started helping people to muck out their houses to stave off the black mold that comes in after a flood. Most of those folks just had basement flooding, it seems, and so we're going to start focusing on schools, getting them up online so that kids can have a sense of normalcy, as well as clearing debris out of community centers so that those community centers can start serving their community rather than just being, you know, full of the debris that blew in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the complementary currency system that I mentioned is sort of a flagship project right now because we do want to get this on people's phones in Kent and across Africa now that these charges have been dropped. So there's going to be quite a bit of time spent figuring out, you know, how do we make this successful so that people have a chance to get out of poverty. So it's
mm-hmm.
really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And and we have volunteer projects too. So if you're interested in volunteering, you can go to our volunteer page and check out what we have going on.
How exciting. Well, thank you so much, Carmen. It's been such a delightful afternoon sitting here talking to you about Burners Without Borders. Carmen's the executive director of and founder of Burners Without Borders that developed out of the Burning Man event that happens every summer. And they have over 25 projects that are occurring around the world. And you can go to their website at burnerswithoutborders.com or .org, sorry, .org, and take a look at what they're doing. This is Robin White Turtle Listening, and you can check out my work at www.thecenterforthesoul.com. So thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Evolve.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for Convergence with John Caracella, Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Evolve was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE.